This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. This program is coming to you from public radio station KELW in San Francisco. The topic on this segment of the program will be a discussion of personal injury and professional malpractice law. My guest is Keith Clifford, a civil trial specialist and pretrial specialist certified by the National Board of Trial Advocacy. Mr. Clifford is the director of the National Board of Trial Advocacy. His law firm, Clifford and Raihulla, is in Madison, Wisconsin. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights and the public radio satellite transmission is made possible by the National Board of Trial Advocacy. Additional funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section, and the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar of California, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Keith, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Chuck. I'm happy to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. Would you do this? And I am incredibly pleased that the National Board of Trial Advocacy has joined as a funder of Your Legal Rights to expand what we're doing across the country. So would you tell us a little bit about the National Board of Trial Advocacy? And what I'd like to do is just say NBTA as many times as we can without giving the whole thing.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, right.
The first thing I'll tell you about the NBTA is that we're proud to be sponsors of your program.
Thank you.
We've admired it for a long time. Several of our officers have been guests on your program last year, and we look forward to a long, positive relationship with you.
I do, too. Thank you.
So what is the National Board of Trial Advocacy? It is a national nonprofit organization that certifies that attorneys who qualify are, in fact, qualified specialists in various legal specialty areas. We're the oldest and largest ABA-accredited attorney certification.
ABA, American Bar Association.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And we certify lawyers in specialty areas of civil trial advocacy, criminal trial advocacy, family law, Social Security disability law, civil pretrial practice. I think I've got them all. But I'm excited to note that we're making plans, even as we speak, Chuck, to add on two new certification areas, one in immigration law and one in appellate advocacy.
That's terrific. That's terrific. How long do you think it'll be before they're certified?
It's a big process. We have to go through the accreditation process with the American Bar Association, as you mentioned. And that might take a total of several years, but we already have organized units within the NBTA to address that. We have members, and we've appointed chairs of those sections of the board. So we're moving apace, and hopefully it'll be soon.
The NBTA has members across the country.
We do.
And what is the significance of this, to be a certified specialist in the specialties that the NBTA certifies? What's the significance of this to the average consumer who may need some legal assistance, some legal representation?
Well, I think actually board certification, which basically says, and it's not unlike medical board certification, they got out of the chute and doing board certification several decades before the legal system did, but it became known probably in the 1970s that a number of beneficiary audiences would benefit from specialization by lawyers and then certification of those specialties. One beneficiary is the judicial system itself. Early in the 1970s, Chief Justice Berger of the U.S. Supreme Court spoke. We call it an historical speech, where he addressed the need of our trial courts to have qualified and specialized trial advocates. He compared it to pilots who have learned how to fly a Piper Cub and know something about flying, but certainly weren't ready to fly modern jetliners. And he drew the analogy that in the courtrooms as he saw it of America today, that or back then, that he called it the painful fact that those courtrooms all too often had Piper Cub advocates trying to handle the controls of Boeing 747 litigation. So he felt, it was, and many other jurists felt, that the judicial system itself, it was going to render fair results from litigation that came through the system, needed specialists in trial advocacy. The legal profession was a beneficiary of it because it became clear that it promoted excellence among lawyers. It encouraged lawyers to concentrate in specialty areas, to decline involvement in cases that were outside their expertise and experience. But most importantly, as you mentioned, it serves the consumer. And I think it's pretty clear, most people would understand, it's hard to hire a lawyer. It's hard to find out who should be hired for a given problem, who's competent in a given legal area that a client may need representation in. This got confounded, if you will, by the proliferation of lawyer advertising, which is something that's happened during your career and mine, and before that wasn't around. And now with TV advertising, people can be told by advertising that lawyers are competent in different areas when they really don't have recognized expertise and experience and competence. So the fact that there's a independent board, the NBTA, that certifies that an attorney has met rigorous and objective standards in a given specialty is something that the average consumer can rely upon in seeking representation.
I think that this would be a good point for me to mention something, Keith. As I think everyone who's listened to this program for any period of time knows that in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and on the Internet, www.kalw.org, this program is on for an hour. Now, with the funding of the NBTA, we are now on the NPR satellite, or the public radio satellite, across the country. I'd like to let all of you know that if you're interested in looking into this further, perhaps looking for a certified specialist in one of the specialties that my guest has mentioned, you can go to the National Board of Trial Advocacy on the website www.nblsc.us. And I think, Keith, you better tell our listeners what NB as in boy, LSC.us stands for.
You didn't tell me there'd be a pop quiz, Chuck, but that's the
national. I wanted to see if you'd take it.
I can do it. It's the National Board of Legal Specialty Certification.
Okay, then that's the website, and there's also a phone number, main phone number for them. Area code 866-384-6565. For those of you who are listening,
www.nbta.org.
Okay, all right, nbta.org. Also, I want to let those of you who are listening to the program live let you know that in the second half hour, by the way, we're doing this program live on May 6th of 2015. In the second half hour, I will be inviting you to call in and ask a question, make a comment if you'd like. And that toll-free number, if you'd like to jot it down, is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Keith, you have a long list of awards for your very hard and good work as an attorney, and I'm not going to list those, but there's one that I find very interesting that I'd like you to let the listeners know about, and that is you were a member, a 17-year member of the board for the City of Madison, Wisconsin Board of Ethics, and you were, I guess at the end of your term, you were chair. What did that all boil down to?
Well, interesting question. That it's generally true that that municipalities and state governments and county governments have codes of ethics that apply to their officials, their elected officials, and their employees, dealing with conflicts of interest and, you know, prohibiting financial gain from public service, cronyism, all those types of things, to put them broadly. Our Board of Ethics passed its own code of ethics while I was there and had hearings on complaints by citizens or others that a public official had violated the code of ethics. So it was generally a policing of the ethical conduct of the employees and officials of the city in that case. Is there sort of an interface of that sort of thing, governmental ethics, with legal ethics? As you know, Chuck, all of us lawyers are under professional responsibility obligations, ethical codes that monitor how we practice and require pretty strict compliance, and interfaces well with the National Board of Trial Advocacy. One of the things we do when we do rigorous examination of the qualifications of attorneys for specialty certification is determine whether or not they've complied with their home state ethical codes, whether they have any problems in that regard, whether they have any conduct issues, as well as requiring them to meet requirements of substantial involvement in the specialty area, pass a rigorous examination, 6-hour test. So we look pretty carefully at all aspects of the professional service of an attorney.
What is the nature of your practice? What areas are you covering?
I'm a plaintiff's trial lawyer. I do predominantly, if not exclusively, negligence cases. There are sort of two categories. I think one is just cases of ordinary negligence. Most people would recognize that as automobile accidents, products liability, premises liability. And then the other is professional malpractice. I do a lot of that, not just medical malpractice, but other areas of malpractice dealing with other professions. And to sort of make a distinction, the law presumes that jurors are fully competent to determine whether a fellow citizen has committed an act of ordinary negligence, violated just sort of a general rule of our society, maybe went speeding in a car and hit somebody, drove while intoxicated or while texting on their phone. And juries are competent to determine on their own whether or not that violates a standard of care, an ordinary standard of care that each of us owes to the other. Professional malpractice, whether it's medical or pharmacy or nursing or legal, accounting, architectural, their negligence isn't measured by what ordinary people do, but measured against the standards within a profession. So generally, the law presumes that a juror needs expert testimony to advise what the standards are in a given profession and whether or not there was a violation of those standards.
And so what you're talking about is your practice goes into professional negligence, as you mentioned, medical, lawyer, accountant, architect, and I presume if the case comes to you, some other area of professionalism. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
I know that there was a case that, everyone or a lot of people are certainly familiar with all of the problems of Enron, what that did, et cetera. I understand that you have been involved in an accounting malpractice case that involved millions of dollars that investors had lost due to management fraud. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about this so that the listeners can understand that professional negligence covers such things as the case that you were involved with.
Sure, and I think the importance of it is that one benefit of malpractice actions, professional malpractice actions, is that it tends to enforce, sort of on behalf of the general public, the standards which apply within a given profession. And in the case you're referring to, we had a group of investors who invested millions of dollars in a company based on the belief that the company was financially solid and sound. And they relied upon audits of an independent accounting firm to reach that conclusion. In truth, the managers, who were insiders, of course, had systematically looted the company. They divested assets of the company to a separate business which they owned. And just before a national regulator came in to audit, do its own audit of the company, the insiders paid themselves literally millions of dollars. And that rendered the company insolvent, and it went into receivership. So the managers wound up being criminally charged, but that left the investors holding the bag. They had lost all their money, and the question arose, well, gee, why didn't the accountants who did the audits of the financial records of this company, why didn't they report this fraud to the investors? And we learned that, sure enough, there were professional standards of due professional care that say the auditors, in fact, should have disclosed it, should have detected it.
So you're saying the auditors knew that there was this looting that had been going on. Is that right?
Well, I think it was right in front of their face.
I see.
And after Enron and WorldCom and those terrible crashes that cost people, tens of thousands of people lost their retirement accounts, millions of investors lost millions of dollars. It had a tremendous impact on our economy. And it became clear that as an adjunct of the corporate mismanagement in those companies, Enron particularly, that there was an accounting scandal going on, that the accountants knew what was happening within Enron and looked the other way. You may recall stories of Arthur Andersen, a company that doesn't exist anymore, having midnight paper shredding parties. They shredded hundreds of thousands of documents relating to their work. Well, that led the accounting profession at large to decide to create new standards of conduct for CPAs who perform audits of companies. And the old dilemma had been that accounting firms who perform audits are actually hired by the managers of a company to do the audit, not by the investors. And they're paid by the managers, not the investors. And they're, above all, they want the managers to hire them again next year and the year after and the year after that. So there's a tendency to not only rely upon the managers as being truthful and assume that they're being honest, but also not to ask them uncomfortable questions. And the new standards that were adopted after Enron said CPAs shouldn't be seduced by the managers and by their personal relationship with the managers and by their even by their belief that managers might be honest. They had to, the specific things they had to do from that point forward were to have a professional skepticism, which is sort of a buzzword for auditing, that they have to kind of make no assumptions about the honesty of managers. They have to sort of plan on disbelieving the information they're provided and test it out to see whether or not it's true rather than just assuming that it is.
Is this a national standard?
It is. It is. And it's adopted. What surprised us a little bit in this case was that the accounting firm that we were suing, the accountants acted as if they'd never heard of these things. So it's like we're telling them for the first time.
Well, that's not very good, is it?
It was not. So they finally, we put it to them that they had missed all of these standards. They didn't identify the risks for fraud, which are part of the new standards. They didn't detect fraud, which are part of the, they didn't have brainstorming sessions where they're supposed to consider, well, how could the managers commit fraud in this case? So finally, we got to the point where we resolved the case and actually recovered significant sums for our clients, never 100%, but certainly much more than they anticipated. And basically, we were not only enforcing the standards in that case against that accounting firm, but we're hoping that other accounting firms will realize this is serious stuff. They really do have a duty to investors and to others to make sure that they've thoroughly tested the information so that the financial records are, in fact, reliable.
This success that you had in this case of showing the fraud that went on and recovering millions of dollars for these investors who were left holding the bag, does the National Board of Trial Advocacy, when there's a result like this by one of their attorneys who's a specialist such as yourself, does the National Board send out this kind of information to its memberships or to any kind of publications throughout the country so that laypersons can realize what's going on in terms of trying to work toward honesty among businesses, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, in several ways. We have a listserv among our members that we can consult with each other and point out areas in which we've had successes and that we think are of importance to other certified trial lawyers or other advocates. The general public can go to our website and learn about what our members have accomplished, what new areas of litigation we've been successful in. And so there are a lot of ways in which we communicate this type of information, certainly through the legal profession, but also to the public.
Let me just do this for a moment. Keith, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're coming to you from public radio station KALW in San Francisco. My guest is Keith Clifford, a civil trial specialist, pretrial specialist certified by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which is now become an additional funder of your legal rights. Mr. Clifford's firm is in Madison, Wisconsin. His firm is Clifford and Raihala. And in a few minutes, I will give the phone number where those of you who are able to listen to the program during the entire full hour, in the second half hour, will have a chance to call in and ask some questions, make some comments if you like. Would you do this, Keith? One of the things, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, that you do in your practice is you handle personal injury cases. Are there some general recommendations, some suggestions you have for persons who have been injured in personal injury cases by the negligence of someone else, things that you might suggest to them to keep in mind if they are injured and what they should do?
Sure. Off the top of my head, I would say that it is important that they learn what their legal rights are. Good name for your show. I think that the general consumer out there is primarily a stranger to the legal system. Very few people who come to my office have ever talked to a lawyer before.
They're scared of them, aren't they, generally speaking?
I think they are. And
I think so.
There's an unfortunate image that's been portrayed over the years that there's something wrong about enforcing your rights. And I never have a meeting with a new client where they don't at some point say, I'm not a litigious person. I'm not one of those kinds of people. And I quickly point out there is no such kind of person. There are only people who come here because they've been injured and they don't know what to do. They don't know how to get their lives back in order. So there is a bit of a stigma to talking to lawyers, and that's unfortunate because lawyers don't take people kicking and dragging, screaming into courtrooms on cases that don't have merit. That doesn't make any sense. We almost all work on a percentage basis, meaning that we don't get paid if there's no recovery, and there's no recovery in a case that doesn't exist. So when people are harmed, it's important that they learn what their legal rights are. And most lawyers will be very blunt with a client and say, look, you don't have a case to be brought here. It was good that you came and talked about it, but this really isn't the kind of case that should be brought in our courts. Generally speaking, I raised my children to trust their instincts, and most people who come to see a lawyer have struggled with the concept and believe they really need to do that. You know, I try to make to distill what this is all about down to really basic stuff. The fact is that we were all raised to be responsible. We were all told when we were kids, if you throw a baseball through the next-door neighbor's window, you go next door and you offer to pay for it. And that's basically what the system of justice we have is. It says that if you're injured through somebody else's negligence, that person is responsible to you. And it's a uniformly believed principle that each of us should be responsible for harm we've done to another. So if people are injured, they should recognize that, realize there's nothing wrong with assuming that, in fact, the wrongdoer will be responsible and will do what they have to do to make things right.
And on the other hand, the other part of your practice where you bring cases against professional malpractice, if someone believes he or she or they have been, whether it's medical malpractice or it's legal malpractice or accountant malpractice or architectural malpractice, what basic recommendations do you have for them if they think that they have been a victim of that kind of, let's say, negligence?
For starters, the same, that they should have it evaluated. They should understand their rights. But they should understand early on that that determining whether or not they can do something about it now has become a very difficult course. A lot of states, such as mine, have adopted really difficult obstacles and obstructions and caps on compensation and things that make it very, very difficult to bring cases in, say, medical malpractice, even though the patient might be very deserving of it. And sadly, these caps that have been put in place harm the patient that's been harmed the most severely injured, is the most clearly affected by low caps on recoveries. So they have to understand that there are a lot of factors in terms of whether or not they can bring their case, even if negligence has occurred. And, you know, again, in medical malpractice, I think that these cases can help regulate the profession. You know, back in 1999, the Institute of Medicine issued a report called "Air is Human," and they said that up to 98,000 people per year die in our hospitals due to preventable medical error. That's a huge number, and subsequent studies have said it's higher. And in response to that, you know, states and on a national level, there was a National Patient Safety Institute that was formed. There were state patient safety institutes formed. I was on the one here in Wisconsin. So these organizations, in good faith, attempted to address and to come up with standards to prevent wrong site surgeries, to prevent medication errors. And they've had a beneficial effect. But recently it was found out, the same organization maybe 5-6 years ago said that did a study and determined that for every day a patient is in the hospital after the first day, they will on average have one medication error per day.
Mm. Wow.
And that's just stunning.
Oh, my.
But and that was, you know, half a decade after "To Air as Human" came out. So while there are strong efforts to try to improve patient safety within hospitals, there are still, sadly and shockingly, frequent events of negligent acts that medical malpractice cases tend to regulate to an extent.
Keith, we are coming to the end of the statewide version in California. And so to let everybody know, we will, Keith Clifford and I will be back, if you're listening to the live program, in just a few seconds. All right. This is Your Legal Rights, coming to you from public radio station KLW in San Francisco. If you have a question, a comment, would like to present something on the air that you feel you're interested in and perhaps other listeners may be interested in, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Talk. 8255 is T-A-L-K on your phone. So it's 866-798-8255. Talk. Whether you are listening to us in the Bay Area, whether you're listening to us on the internet at www.klw.org, or if you're listening to us via the public radio satellite, I welcome your calls. That's the whole point of this program, to try to educate people, to try to help you prevent problems. If you have a problem, try to give you some direction of where to go next. My guest is Keith Clifford. He's a civil trial specialist and pretrial specialist certified by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, NBTA. He is a director of NBTA. His law firm is in Madison, Wisconsin, and it is known as Clifford and Raihala. And I'd like to have you join us on the air in just a couple of minutes. I want to give a couple of announcements, if I may, to all of you. For those of you in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. And for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, California, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral number. That's 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you are in any other county in California, and I can't at this point speak to other states' counties, but I suspect this is probably true throughout the United States, and I'm going to give the example, at least in California. If you are in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what your problem is. They'll do their best to try to find someone who's experienced for you and set you up for a half an hour consultation with an attorney. And with minor exception, for a half an hour consultation, you will be charged somewhere between $25 to $35. That money does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service as a public service to keep that going. The other thing I want to let you know about, for those of you in the San Francisco Bay Area, is a community forum that's free and open to the public entitled Meet the Judges, which will be on Thursday, May 14th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at UC Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco, 200 McAllister Street. This is where judges and their representatives of the San Francisco Superior Court will be on hand to explain their departments and answer questions about the court processes and more. This is presented by the Bar Association of San Francisco and the Superior Court of California, County of San Francisco. And for those of you who have joined us in the last few minutes, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. My guest is Keith Clifford, a civil trials specialist and also pretrial specialist certified by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which is funding this segment, and it's also funding the public radio satellite of this program across the country. And so we're going to start with Karen. Welcome to the program.
Good evening, Chuck and Keith. Thank you so much. So back when they had the Enron and the Arthur Anderson, I believe some of the Bush family were involved in that, there were thousands of people that were found guilty of fraud and shredding and all kinds of other devious things, and they were prosecuted, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people that served jail time. But in the 2008, where we had the liar's loans and the zombie banks and the credit default swaps and the hedge funds, and people's deed of trust was sliced up and sold all over the world, and had this big, you know, it was the people that lost all this money and lost their homes and lost their titles to their property that suffered and are still continuing to suffer. And none of those people, none of them have been prosecuted or served any jail time at all that I know of. So I'm wondering, you know, we all are very concerned about doing the right thing and being above board and making sure that we're ethical, but the whole, the banking and the real estate, that whole thing, they just, even when they had that big LIBOR thing in England, they don't even call it criminal, they call it a scandal. Oh, it's another scandal. Well, it's not a scandal. It's criminal behavior, and it's never really prosecuted. So it's very frustrating for people out there that are really suffering and trying hard to do the right thing, and I wonder what you think about that.
Karen, where are you calling from?
I'm in Berkeley.
Are you? Okay, yes. Well, thank you very much. If you take the response on the air.
I will. Thank you very much.
Let me mention something to you, I want you to know this. I've been with the San Mateo County District Attorney's Office. This is my actually 30th year. And in my early career, I was doing economic crime, actually prosecuting companies, prosecuting individuals who had companies for misrepresentations, fraud, et cetera. So it is not that unusual, I don't think, in certainly in California. What comments do you have for Karen, Keith?
Well, first I'll point out quickly that I'm board certified as a civil trial advocate, not as a criminal trial advocate.
Yes.
That's another certification, so I'm not probably competent to explain why those charges aren't brought. Karen makes a good point that obviously tens of thousands of people were harmed directly, but the harm that she's describing is also a harm to our entire economy, to our whole society. It's harm to the public, and it is disappointing. I mean, I can only say this personally. I'm not speaking on behalf of the National Board of Trial Advocacy, but it is disappointing that no action was ever taken directly against any of those people who brought such harm to so many. I don't know why those decisions were made, but I share her frustration in it.
All right. We have, by the way, let me give you the phone number again, 866-798-8255. That's 8255 is TALK. Maria, welcome to the program, and where are you calling from?
Oh, hi, good evening. I'm calling from San Francisco.
Uh-huh, go ahead.
Well, I have a problem that is really a hard case. It's a malpractice from Kaiser. I had an operation in my arm, and the nurses say took the stitches before it heals. I went to the next day, and they leave open the wound for about a month. And my arm is still immobile, and they told me I cannot sue them. make a complaint against malpractice. Yeah, they told me it's not malpractice because the nurses say did it. They took the stitches before heal, and they I can do anything. I have to get another operation because of this.
Now, wait a minute, Marie. Let me ask you something. You're saying someone told you you can't sue them? Who told you that?
I called two lawyers. Even if it was 100% malpractice, they told me Kaiser is impossible to sue, and I will be immobilized. I have I cannot hold even a pen with my hand, and they told me I can do anything against Kaiser.
Well, that's very interesting. Let me get some comments from Keith on this. If you'll turn your radio back up, Maria, Keith, obviously you cannot give specific legal advice on the air. That's impossible, both from the standpoint of the ethics of it as well as the time that we have. But what suggestions do you have for her when she's been told that this particular medical facility is impossible to sue? I find that to be difficult to accept, but I'm wondering what comments you have.
Well, I can't comment on that. Obviously, I don't know what facility it is.
Yeah.
I will say that some medical facilities in some communities are such a strong component of the community that it's very difficult to bring a claim against them.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean it's legally impossible. It's just not a rational thing to do. One of my earliest cases involved a suit against the local hospital, a very rural community, and three members of the jury were members of the hospital auxiliary.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
And three others were patients of the doctor I was seeing.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
And we won.
You really, in spite of that? That's fantastic.
Much to my surprise.
Wow.
But I think that the advice she's getting, and I think she should try to clarify it from the attorney.
Yes, I do, too.
I generally tell clients that if we cannot bring a claim, it will be because I've determined that it isn't medically viable. I can't prove it as a matter of medical science.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's not legally viable. I can't.
Mm-hmm.
Prove it in court, or that it's economically not viable, that the amount of recovery that I could obtain, even if we win, doesn't justify bringing it because they're such expensive cases to bring.
What I might suggest, and I have no idea who Maria has contacted to get some advice on this, but I am presuming, and you correct me if I'm wrong here, Keith, I'm presuming that there are some certified specialists of the NBTA in the Bay Area. How does she go about in trying to find out who these people are, and what website might she go to, or what would you suggest she do?
She can go directly to our website, as we've identified it earlier, and search in California for a civil trial advocacy specialist.
And the website that you would recommend is what?
www.nbta.org.
NBTA, that's the National Board of Trial Advocates.org. www.nbta.org. And then, Maria, look in California and see who you might find there. Here's a question.
By the way, I want to add that I'm a very strong believer in getting second opinions.
I am, too.
Every lawyer's opinion is often very subjective,
yeah,
based on that lawyer's experience, and it's not a universal truth. So by all means, you should feel free to contact another qualified lawyer and see if the first opinion she got was correct.
Yeah, yeah. Good luck to you, Maria. Before we take another call, let me just mention something was brought into me, a question. Maybe one of the reasons for the high rate of medical malpractice is that doctors and residents are required to work long shifts, as long as 36 hours. Anyone who is that sleep deprived is probably going to make errors. Why isn't this practice stopped? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that they are stopping it. I think that the hours that they put residents through is considered to be a meaningless exercise in many respects, and they've tried to police that a little bit and reduce the number of hours, recognizing that, being that tired, that exhausted, is certain to lead to failure.
I would think so. I would think so, if you can even stay awake that long,
yeah,
frankly. Our number again for your legal rights, the toll-free number, 866-798-8255. That's Talk. My guest is Keith Clifford, civil trial specialist, pretrial specialist certified by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which has become a funder of this program and is funding not only a number of programs over the next 12 months, but also our transmission on the public radio satellite. And the website for the National Board of Trial Advocacy is www.nbta.org. And,
I should clarify that the nblsc.com might be a preferable site.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
nblsc.com or .us?
.us.
.us. nblsc.us.
Yes.
Okay. Maria, jot that down, www.nblsc.us. All right. And Camille, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a more of a general question. It just seems like these days, you know, if you go see the doctor, even if you go online to purchase something, you're signing so many documents, and, you know, there's so much small print, and I'm always wondering, you know, if I'm signing my rights away if something goes wrong.
Camille, do you read the documents?
Well, you know,
huh?
I try, but when they're 40 and 50 pages long.
Wow.
You
wow.
know, it's a lot of fine print. And so the real question is, you know, when you do sign these documents, and I know that there's a lot of hold harmless clauses out there, the question is, you know, how can you really be sure, and, you know, with everything in legalese, not all of us are lawyers.
No.
How can you really be sure that, you know, you're really not signing something you shouldn't be signing? And if you do sign it, is there recourse, or, you know, if something happens, are you just out of luck?
Well, that's a very good question, Camille. And you're calling from where?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm calling from Houston.
Are you? Well,
yeah.
Thank you, Camille, for that question. Thank you very much. You can turn your radio back up and listen to the answer from Keith. Thanks so much for calling. Keith, what comments do you have for Camille?
Well, first, I think that the answer may vary by jurisdiction. Depending on what state you're in, and I don't think it's necessarily a universal answer. I think that generally it's viewed as inappropriate for healthcare providers to put that kind of poison pill in any documents you might sign. But I will certainly point out that, for example, if you're checking a family member into a nursing home and you're to sign those 90 pages of documents, I've done it, and frankly, as a lawyer, I couldn't figure out what they are.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's these things are often done under circumstances where the patient doesn't have a full and clear opportunity to understand what they're signing, to have it explained. So I think in many respects, where if you do run into that, it probably would be challengeable under the law. And I would certainly feel it's not a best practice of medicine to require patients to do that.
I also think that if you are in an emergency situation and you're presented with a whole bunch of documents to sign before they perform medical services, that's the kind of thing that would really, frankly, should there be negligence, medical malpractice, that a jury would not be happy about at all, even though you may have signed some documents.
Not at all, and I think you're absolutely right on that, Chuck.
Yeah. All right, I want to give you the phone number again in case you'd like to call in. We have a few minutes left with my guest, Keith Clifford, on Your Legal Rights. It's 866-798-8255, TALK. For those of you who are in California, as well as wherever you're listening to the program, whether it's on the Internet or the satellite, we have a procedure here or a practice here that I've had for many, many, many years, a whole bunch of years ago in conjunction with the State Bar of California, which is the original funder of this program and still is a major funder of Your Legal Rights. Usually on the fourth Wednesday of the month, we have something while I'm doing a live program. We have what's called Call a Lawyer Night. And I will have at the station, at public radio station KALW in San Francisco, I will have a number of attorneys in the conference room here on an 800 number. And while I'm doing the live program, live on from 7 to 8 p.m. California time, You can call in and speak to an attorney off the air, no obligation whatsoever. And even though you may not be a resident of the state of California, there may be some valuable information that you might get if you're listening to this program outside of California by calling and speaking to one of these attorneys. So keep that in mind, the fourth Wednesday of May, and that will be, of course, the 27th of May this month. So you might put it on your calendar that we're going to do that, call a lawyer night. And if you want to jot down the 800 number, 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917. And for those of you who are listening to this program right now, we're doing this program live on May 6th. So when I give the phone number of 866-798-8255, that's for today only, until I announce it again on another live program. So, Keith, here we are. We've got a few minutes left. No one else is waiting to speak to you. What else have you thought of that you'd like to alert listeners to in terms of protecting themselves or being more attuned to not just thinking, well, what can I do, and just sitting on their hands?
Well, I do think that I'd encourage anybody who feels that they're sort of lost at sea. They don't know what to do when they feel they've been harmed, and they don't know for sure that they have any legal rights that apply to that. Certainly contact a board-certified lawyer. Almost universally, we're happy to speak with people free of charge to determine whether or not they have a claim and whether they should bring it, whether or not it's a reasonable thing to do, and to explain the pathway forward. And again, almost universally, board-certified attorneys will say there's no obligation, you don't have to hire me if you choose not to, but start getting some ground under your feet and figure out where you can go with your problem. Now, the medical malpractice questions are befuddling sometimes because legislatures around the country have made it very, very difficult to bring these cases. And I don't know whether that's contributing to the inability to control some of these errors that keep getting made, but we see with regular frequency cases that are categorized as never events. Things that should never happen in a hospital.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wrong site surgeries, medication errors.
Yeah.
We're dealing with one right now where the patient caught on fire in the operating room.
Oh, my.
And that's got to be something that's never happened before.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's a well-known phenomenon. It happens because alcohol is used as the prep solution in getting a patient ready for incision, which is good, but it's also dangerous.
Because alcohol is combustible.
Yeah, it's combustible, and you're in an oxygen-rich environment. The anesthesia is coming. The anesthetist is giving high oxygen concentration, and the surgeon is using the source of ignition, a bovipen, which is a sharp cautery knife. And so, it's a well-known and understood proposition. Everybody in the operating room knows it, but it still happens.
Pardon me, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. Here's another question that was just brought into the studio, and buried in a lot of fine print, as Camille brought up, is arbitration clauses in a number of different areas. In the case of a dispute, the customer is required, and I'm not just talking about right now medical, but let's say it's a dispute with a company or a dispute with an employer or a dispute with a bank or whatever. The customer is required to go through arbitration and can't go to court. Do you think we'll start seeing arbitration clauses popping up in the context of medical services as a way of limiting malpractice lawsuits?
Not that they need any further limitations on the ability to bring them, but yes,
yeah.
I do.
Do you?
Mm-hmm. It's a sad consequence of things, but the truth of the matter is that they've worked their way into almost every kind of transaction we have. And the sad truth is that businesses win 93% of those arbitrations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're very expensive
mm-hmm.
for the citizen, the average consumer, to have to deal with. And the cards are stacked dramatically against them. Even if they go through the process, their odds unlikely to lose.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real terrible abandonment of our judicial system for no good for the public at large.
So what do you think the public should do? Should we be contacting our legislators to try to propose legislation to prevent something like this?
Absolutely. I think that even that most legislators don't have any clue about this, have no idea that that's going on, but think of all the transactions that are done online.
Yes.
And we sign off on these things, and we never read the terms and conditions, all that fine print that goes on, keeps scrolling, and it goes on forever. And buried in that often is an arbitration clause that gives up your rights to seek justice. And, you know, we have the best system of justice in the world. And to deprive people of access to it is just an awful shame. It just shouldn't happen. So certainly letting legislators know that they ought to stop this, they ought to step into the arena and prohibit this. And by the way, letting businesses know that if you're going to require this, I'm going to go somewhere else. Now, the marketplace doesn't favor the consumer on this at all.
Yes.
And it's getting worse and worse. But I think it's worthwhile taking a stand somewhere.
Well, that's good. What other thoughts do you have for us in terms of the general population trying to protect themselves with respect to negligence, whether it's accidents or professional negligence? Other thoughts you might have for us?
Well, I think that as we've been talking, I think it's important that people learn what their legal rights are. And by the way, your show is very helpful in that regard. You've been doing this for decades, and I think people have learned a lot about that, about what rights they do have.
I hope they have. That was the whole point of it.
Well, I think it works, Chuck, and I think that it's important to keep talking about it, because the public just needs to know that there are ways that their rights can be vindicated and protected. There are a lot of good lawyers out there who are of good heart and want to do nothing more than make sure that if somebody's broken your window, they'll help you get it fixed. And I think that that's just what our system is all about. It's a fairly simple proposition. Nobody disputes the rightness of it. So I think that it's just a matter of realizing that people shouldn't be afraid of going to talk to a lawyer, shouldn't be worried about being viewed as part of the litigiousness of America, which is just a falsehood, and should at least learn what their rights are and then make an educated decision about what they want to do about it.
You know, one of the things as we've been talking about medical malpractice, so many the statistics have been because and hopefully across the country this is improving markedly, but one of the problems has been in hospitals, when people have been hospitalized, there are many, many cases of illnesses which didn't originate with the patient coming into the hospital, but did, such as serious infections that have been caused people to be very seriously ill or maybe even die. And what thoughts do you have if someone has a serious illness and needs to go into a hospital to stay in a hospital for a while? What thoughts do you have about that person having with him or her, at least to some degree, an advocate, whether it's a family member or perhaps a close friend or someone like that, to kind of make sure that the staff members are washing their hands, et cetera. Do you have some thoughts about that?
Yeah, I do. I think it's essential that family members or friends, whoever you may have, kind of hover over you. It's pretty well conceded that a patient going into a hospital is very vulnerable, not just to those medication errors that happen on a daily basis, as I mentioned, but to infections, as you referred to. Staff infections are rampant in hospitals. Basically can't be controlled. There are other, you know, untreatable infections that are antibiotic resistant, MRSA. There are dangers of being in a hospital, even though you might be getting the best of care. So in addition to knowing that there are those kinds of problems that should be monitored, and when you see a nurse come in or a pharmacy tech or whoever it may be come into the room and to do something with the patient, and they didn't wash their hands as they came in the door.
Yeah.
Stop them. Yeah. It's
yeah, I agree. Stop them. And don't be afraid to do so.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I feel is very important is that the patient and the advocate and or the advocate have a little notebook with them and take down notes with respect to what may be going on and make sure if you have a question that if there's not a staff member there at that time to write it down so when the staff member comes in, you can ask the question.
Those are excellent ideas. The whole business of being in a hospital and being under treatment is a time of confusion and anxiety and anguish and emotional distress for the patient and for the family, and it's hard to recognize that there probably has been a burden shifted upon them to monitor the care, to make sure the medication that's being given is the right medication. It's difficult to challenge a nurse or to challenge a doctor or challenge any other healthcare provider and say, are you sure this is what this patient is supposed to have? Are you sure that's the right dose? But it's essential that people just be able to address those things forthrightly. And monitoring things and keeping track of things, when was the last medication given? When is it going to be given again? Here's a list of questions I've got. Those are very important interventions by the lay people who are hovering around the patient. And they can't do better service to the patient than protecting them from what's not an intentional harm.
No, it is not.
It's just a negligent harm. And often, most acts of medical malpractice, it has been determined, aren't the acts of the last actor who actually does something wrong. It's a systems failure that every step of the way where there are systems in place to abort the possibility of an error, all of those steps fail.
Let me give the website again, because we've just about come to the end of the program, Keith. www.nblsc.us and also www.nbta.org. Keith Clifford, thanks so much for joining us.
Chuck, it's been a great pleasure.
It's been wonderful to have you on the program. Thank you very much for joining us. Keith Clifford, civil trial specialist, pretrial specialist, director of the National Board of Trial Advocacy Law Firm in Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
Next week on Your Legal Rights on the California broadcast, we'll discuss bullying in the workplace with my guests, employment law attorneys Theodora Lee and Aaron Minnitz. On the satellite broadcast, my guest will be David Rappaport, president of the National Board of Trial Advocacy, who will discuss the legal rights of plaintiffs in personal injury and wrongful death cases. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the National Board of Trial Advocacy. Additional funding of the program is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. The National Board of Trial Advocacy also is the funder of the public radio satellite transmission of this program. Thank you very much for listening to Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney.